So hopefully you've had a chance to just talk a little bit with the person next to you about why you've come here tonight. Come now to, I guess, in some ways, the meat or the kind of the main bit of tonight, which is to hear a little bit from Dr. Alan Gisbus, who is here. I think it's really important that we hear both the personal and the technical side of the story, that we hear from people who've experienced it firsthand and also from professionals. And that's why we've got Alan along tonight, because he's a professional and an experienced person in this field. So I thought I might just start by asking Alan, Alan, what do you do? What's your work? How do you spend your time?
Well, I'm a consultant physician in addiction medicine, so I deal with people who have an addiction problem. I've been doing so for about 25 years now. So I've seen a number of people, and Stuart's story is certainly not anything abnormal at all, except I wish he hadn't run out the door, because I would have loved to have found out what happened 6 years ago and what caused the turnaround from being sort of really down and out. I mean, he sort of hinted at it, but there's a whole journey towards recovery. One of the things I say about people who attend AA, it's a bit like going to the swimming pool. And you can stand on the edge and comment on how everybody's swimming and what their strokes are like and that sort of stuff. But I want to grab the person and shove them into the water and actually do some swimming. And that's the difference between watching people in AA and actually doing it. And I think there are probably Christian analogies to that as well. I really am free associating away. I just want to say more things. AA, it's interesting. If you go back to the very start of AA, it actually was the Keswick Convention in the 1880s that spawned, first of all, the Oxford movement, which led to Frank Borman then becoming interested in promoting the Oxford movement, which Bill W. and Bob somebody or other picked up and made into AA. And it's very interesting, if you look at the AA literature, there are those who are conservative Christians in America, and they're at the moment sort of really pouring honour on themselves at the present time, aren't they? But anyway, they want to claim AA as a Christian organisation, and then there are those who say, no, we want to maintain the higher power as being whatever you want it to be and to allow a far more pluralistic approach within AA. So you've got these tensions. But it does mean that as a Christian doctor, I can then turn around to a person and say, well, what do you think of the higher power? What is your higher power? Who is it? But at the same time, giving the person the freedom to be able to explore who their higher power is. And I've had all sorts of interesting replies. One of the most interesting ones was a person who was a very rigid religious person and who said that with going to AA, God has become more loving and more mysterious. Now, I think that that's not a bad spiritual development. I don't know about you, but to discover that God is not just a set of rules and regulations. I think he was from a Catholic background, if I remember correctly. And so to discover that God is more loving than judgmental and more mysterious because there are bits of him that I don't understand. Listen, I better let you back to the questions, haven't you? Right.
No, it's really interesting, okay. I think. Yeah, because, I mean, when you read the 12 steps, it sort of reads like you're sort of getting like 70 or 80% of the gospel, but it doesn't quite get to Jesus, which is fascinating. But
can always inject Jesus into it, of course, if you want to.
I think that's what we
as Christians need to have a much greater degree of freedom. We're prepared to sort of insert our bit, but do it so respectfully and do it so recognising that there are other people who have a different way of looking at it. How can we truly be committed to a Christian faith and yet at the same time give the other people the freedom? And I think that this issue of freedom will come up again and again in the discussion tonight.
Yeah. Alan, what's your training or experience in relation to addiction? What's your sort of expertise in this area that we've invited you on?
Well, I trained as a general physician in general medicine. I worked in India for 5 years as a missionary doctor, came back and worked at St. Vincent's Hospital. Anybody who works at St. Vincent's Hospital usually gets to deal with addictions in a roundabout sort of a way anyway, but then there was a Department of Community Medicine there, so I worked with them. And then Turning Point around the corner was starting to do doing clinical studies, I should say, rather than experiments. This sounds awful, doesn't it? Doing clinical studies with methadone and buprenorphine, the substitution pharmacotherapy, so I got involved with that, and gradually I started to realise that addiction, the technical side is easy. It's the people that make it difficult, because so many are will only allow you to do so much with them. And of course, part of the whole thing is to then work with them and to stay with them and to be on a journey to recovery, which means that you just have got to be patient and allow the pennies to drop. And gradually they develop insight and understanding into who they are. Look, I think most of you believers here, a bit like evangelism really, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're wanting to give people the freedom of choice and yet at the same time be face up to the questions that you might need to deal with. And then St. Vincent's was jeffed, which means I lost my job. But thankfully there was a private practice around the corner at the Epworth, but then Epworth said, you're not part of our core business, which meant private hospitals don't make enough money out of addictions. So I moved to the Melbourne Clinic, which is a psychiatric institution. I've been there for the last 10, 15 years now, which is an interesting to have dialogue with psychiatrists. They're a completely different breed of people, I think. Some people say, are you a psychiatrist? They say, no, I'm normal. But then I've got to apologise and say, no, that's not true, because there are some terrific psychiatrists who are prepared to work with some very difficult people. And again, the same thing. It's not so much the technical stuff. It really is people. That's the challenge.
Thanks for coming tonight, Alan.
That's all right. Pleasure
to have you. Okay, so I thought it could be helpful to just kind of define some of our terms a little bit here. I think often when people are talking about drugs and addiction, these are kind of like many words that can be used in a variety of different ways. So when you talk to one person about drugs, they might be thinking of one category of things, and somebody else, they have a different idea in mind. So I thought I'd just, I wanted to ask you, Alan, what are we talking about? When we say drugs, what word are we really, you know, what are we trying to mean there? What are we referring to?
Okay, well, I mean, a drug is a chemical that alters bodily function. And the particular drugs we're interested in are drugs that change brain function. And particularly, well, I mean, there are lots of drugs that change brain function and they do well. I mean, my psychiatric colleagues use all sorts of medications for depression and anxiety and psychosis and those sort of things. So the idea that drugs are bad is really not right. I mean, if drugs are good, we call them medicines. If drugs are bad, we call them poisons, all right? But it's not as easy as to say this drug is a poison, this drug is a medicine. I mean, if you use the drug opium, by the way, a guy called Thomas Sydenham, who is a Christian, been many years ago, he's called the English Hippocrates, the father of modern English medicine. He said one of God's greatest gifts to humankind is the gift of opium. So there you go. And so whenever you have a post-operative pain and you get your morphine, wow, thank goodness for pain, for morphine to treat pain. And of course, but if you use morphine too much, then morphine's no longer a good thing, it becomes a bad thing. And I think one of the most important things to say at this point is that the alcohol that you guys have been drinking when you came in here, that's a drug also. Alcohol is not a drink, it's a drug. And it does good things. As John Wesley says, your loosened tongues employ. Alcohol can also be a problem as well. And I think we've got to be more subtle about drug use and recognise that in the right amounts and in the right context, it's appropriate. In the wrong amounts, in the wrong context, it's not appropriate. I think that's a better way of understanding drug use. What do the drugs that I'm interested in do? They stimulate the pleasure centre of the brain. Listen, you doer Christians, humans are built for pleasure. We've got pleasure hormones circulating in our brains. We've got endorphins, which are opium-based. We've got anandamides, which is cannabis-based. But we have natural cannabinoids circulating around in our brain. And we have other dopamine and serotonin and all those. You wouldn't believe it, perhaps, but God built us for pleasure. Huh. Oh. Of course, you've heard of Paul's latest letter to the Ephesians, haven't you? Dear Ephesians, I hear you are enjoying yourself. Stop, signed Paul. Now, but I do think that, you know, pleasure in the right place is appropriate, right? Now, when I ask medical students, why are we built for pleasure? Medical students say, oh, sex. Yeah, and what happens then? Well, what do you mean? Well, sex produces babies. Ah, right. And what happens with babies? Well, they need to be brought up. And how are babies well brought up? They're well brought up within an environment of pleasure. Kids learn through playing. If they play well. They learn the meanness of me, the you-ness of you. They learn how to manipulate you to do what I want. You know, all that sort of stuff. And if you learn well, you learn to relate well. But also, as Stu described this evening so well, there's also this emptiness as well there. And if we chase that emptiness all the time, then it's a sort of sometimes it's elusive. Right? Have you heard of Francis Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven? Francis Thompson was addicted to both alcohol and laudanum. It was laudanum, which is a mixture of alcohol and opium. And he talks about how God pursued him. The Hound of Heaven fled him down the paths of the year in the midst of time. And whatever I was chasing, everything is elusive until he found, as Augustine says, my heart is restless till I find my rest in you. Now, it doesn't mean that Jesus is the answer to every problem, but it does mean that a faith commitment can make a great degree of difference. And if you look up spiritus contra spiritum, which is a phrase that Carl Jung used in a letter to Bill W. and Bob so-and-so, he talked about a patient of his where the spirit of God drives out the spirit of alcohol. So it seems that addiction is very much a spiritual pursuit, which then raises the question, well, should we make the pursuit of pleasure the most important thing in our lives? And the answer is no. It's what philosophers call the hedonistic fallacy, that if you try to chase for pleasure, you'll never find it. But if you forget about chasing pleasure and just pursue what is good, then pleasure comes in as a side effect.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah. I've been free associating. Sorry about that.
That's interesting stuff. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I think it's really helpful because I think what you're talking about is first of all about, you know, so what is a drug? It's many things, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but actually the problem can be in terms of usage, I think is what I heard. And also that actually the things that many drugs are stimulating in our brains are things that are already present and are positive things, but it's about how much and kind of how that happens. So I guess the second question, just going to...
Only the second question. We've gone fair wave two questions. Yeah, go on.
What are we talking about with addiction? Because that's the kind of second half of our title. We talked about drugs and addiction. What's addiction? What is that?
Okay. Well, I think the first thing to say is that addictive agents aren't just a problem because they cause addiction. If we take alcohol, for instance, 60% of all alcohol-related deaths occur in people who are not addicted to alcohol. Right? They occur because people experiment and play around and they don't know how to control the drug before they become addicted. We'll define addiction a bit later on. In other words, intoxication can be a problem. The old line of booze in, brains out. And of course, the most vulnerable people are the people between the ages of 18 to 25 when they've got their driver's license and a car and there's plenty of testosterone circulating around the place and a bit of aggression and that sort of stuff. And if you want to ask medical students that they want some training in stitching people up, when is the best time to do that? Well, you go on a Friday night or a Saturday night because that's when all the traumas come to the emergency rooms and that's when you get your chance to do as much stitching as you possibly would want. So intoxication is an important problem in relation to alcohol. Gradually people lose their inhibitions and then they lose their social controls and that sort of stuff. In relation to methamphetamine or ice, the problem then can be kind of people become aggressive and psychotic. And when you become psychotic, then everybody becomes somebody who's against you and an enemy, that sort of thing. If you take an overdose of opium, then of course you kill yourself. And that's one of the reasons why I think in the 80s, the Victorian Ambulance thought it would be a good idea that when somebody overdoses on opium that we don't have the police around at the same time. They broke the nexus between policing and drug use, and so the ambulance is now treated as a medical problem rather than a moral problem, which I think is a great improvement. So I just wanted to sort of say that addictive agents do more than cause addiction. Now, what is addiction? Well, addiction is when the pleasure centre becomes in the brain becomes autonomous. That is, you're driven by the pleasure centre so that you don't have the stopping mechanisms that you used to maybe have. And so that the most dominant thing becomes the addiction that you have. And I mean, Stu described that beautifully, where alcohol was now in control of him rather than he in control of the alcohol. And that, of course, can happen with other drugs as well. And that, of course, can happen with addictive behaviours, because we don't just stimulate the pleasure centre of the brain with chemicals. We can stimulate the pleasure centre of the brain with benign things like a good nourishing conversation or fellowship around the dinner table at St. Alf's on a Saturday night or something like that. But we can also do that sort of thing by, say, playing with the pokies, tablets, computer games, internet, shopaholism. We talk about people who are love addicted. At least women are love addicted. Men are sex addicted, according to the pundits in relation to those sort of addictions. So anything which I think just distorts the centre of what we should be and takes over and becomes dominant can be an addiction.
You often hear people saying...
You
often hear people saying that, I'm very addicted to this TV show at the moment, or I'm very addicted to chocolate, or, I'm so addicted to this particular activity, and people say it as a throwaway line. Should we take that seriously when somebody says, oh, I'm really addicted to this Netflix show? Should we say, oh, that's concerning? Or should we just be like, oh, whatever, they're just making a joke? How literally should we take that language of addiction when people use it of themselves?
Oh, I think it varies very much according to the context. I mean, some people, obviously, it can be pretty enslaving. I mean, one of the things about the Christian faith, it talks about freedom. And I think freedom is the great gift that God gives, the gospel gives people. And being free for what and to do what? Now we're starting to ask the bigger question, which is not, what am I addicted to? But what am I here for? What am I living for? What's the direction of my life? And where am I going? Now, God has created us to be part of his world, to live in his world, to be stewards of his creation, to enjoy the balance between work and rest. I have a quote saying, scratch an alcoholic, find a workaholic. And it's possible that we are trying to fill that emptiness that Stuart was talking about by working hard to prove to ourselves that we are not as bad as we deep down really think we are. Oh, that's something, isn't it? But at the end of the day, those of us who are workaholics will sit down and work out all the things that we should have done and haven't done, rather than celebrating the things we have done. And maybe one of the antidotes to workaholism is to develop a good sense of gratitude and a sense of praise and a sense of enjoyment of the good world that God has given us, and to be not to ask too much of ourselves, to be gentle to ourselves, and to help us that way.
Yeah, so we can kind of respond to somebody's substance use or substance addiction, but we actually need to ask the question, what's the problem behind the problem? What is it that people are kind of searching for or seeking for?
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I mean, I often say to patients, look, alcohol's not the problem, alcohol's the solution. Let's work out what the problem is. And I think Stuart described that very nicely when he said, I've got this emptiness. Now, let's face it, most of us have got that emptiness to some extent. But also, that the Christian gospel is such that God comes and says, you are loved. And you are loved deeply, and therefore that you can rest in me and find your strength in that. What? Am I not loud enough?
No.
What? What's wrong? Hey.
Drop your voice enough.
No. Oh, well, then I thought I could just drop my voice. All right, gotcha. Okay, thanks, Ian. So I think that's important. Now, I have this little trick when I... Should I tell you? Yeah, when I'm admitting people to the hospital, I say, before you come in, I want you to realise that in coming into hospital, you've got to obey the rules. Oh, yeah. I've got to do the right thing, yeah. Rule number one, enjoy yourself. Well, alcohol is artificial instant chemical pleasure, or other drugs are artificial instant chemical pleasure, and therefore to take alcohol or other drugs away is to take away your pleasure. Suppose that you are a cup, and that cup is full of air. How do you empty that cup of air? Sorry? Fill it up with water. Yeah, if we try a vacuum, it's an unstable situation. Fill it with water, right? Fill it with better pleasure, right? You know, the story of the demon-possessed person whose spirit was driven out of, and then after a week walking around, wow, that person's empty, and the spirits come back in, and the person's there. So we have all sorts of things, all sorts of programs. It's a secular program. It's not particularly Christian, and yet profoundly Christian in another way. Whereby we try to create an environment where people learn how to enjoy themselves, even though, as I said before, enjoyment is not the main aim of who we are. Enjoyment is a byproduct to doing other things. But I think you'll have problem with rule number two, I say to them. Oh, why is that? Rule number two says you've got to treat everybody with respect. And then you pause and you look them in the eye. Don't have a problem with that. Well, how do you treat Chris Dury? Oh, that's different. And then the tissues come and then they start crying because people try to change their behaviour through beating themselves up and motivate people through shame, through blame, through all of those sort of things. And of course, that doesn't work. And I say to the patients, you've got to gentle yourself better. You're not going to get yourself better by driving yourself better. You've got to gentle yourself better, and in that way, that's how you start to embrace recovery.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think often people seem to have this idea that we can, you know, if we have a sort of punitive approach, if we maybe punish people, criminalise, you know, addictive behaviour or drug use, that might help people stop using a drug or help them stop being addicted. But in some ways that can actually contribute to it. If in fact the problem is that somebody's experiencing a deep amount of emotional pain and our response to that is to inflict more pain and punishment on them, it might actually precipitate, you know, an additional cause to their addiction, which is something to think about. It's something that I've often thought about, is like, how do we actually bring healing and love to people who are experiencing addiction rather than more pain that might actually be the cause? But
well, my mother used to say, the more flies are caught by honey than by vinegar, which I think is sort of one way of putting it. Although, I mean, I do think the appropriate application of carrot and stick is also important. And sometimes we do need to apply some stick. Sure. I mean, when they're given leave to in our clinic, go out and drink, the consequence is that they will be discharged. And those consequences are very clear. So, I mean, we do still have a choice as consequences. And is it Galatians chapter 6, verse 6, if I can remember back to my Bible verses? God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. You know, we reap what we sow. There are consequences. It is 6:6, Ravi, I'm pretty sure. You can check it up for me if you like. Yeah, that's it. The point is that there are choices and consequences. And certainly in codependent relationships, you will find that there is this poor, long-suffering mother who continually still wipes the fevered brow of the lad who is being a total brat and a total prat and has absolutely no regard for consequences at all. I think Stuart's situation, he had to get to his rock bottom, he would describe in AA terms.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And you can actually prevent people from recovery because they are enabled to continue. I mean, I've had fathers who have bought heroin for their kids because they don't want the kids to become involved with the illicit drug scene. Well, that's just a little bit too enmeshed, I think. Although, I mean, it's a real dilemma. What do you do with a kid who doesn't do what you want him to do? I say, my roof, my rules, and I think that that's important. And sometimes people have to show tough love and say, well, look, if you do that, then I'm afraid the consequences are this, and those consequences can be severe. The worst are the lawyers, because they want to protect their son from going to jail if the son's done something bad. But if the son's stolen and spent a lot of money, then the son needs to know that there are consequences to his behaviour.
How does someone become addicted, Alan? I mean, we've talked a little bit about, you know, sort of causes and that sort of thing, but how does it actually happen that someone might end up being addicted, particularly to a substance or to a drug?
Well, as you heard from Stuart, there's a journey that people go on, and one of the privileges that I have is to ask the question, tell me, how did you go on this journey? When did it start, and what happened? And those journeys are enormously varied depending on the person you talk to. The youngest alcoholic I had was a lass who I saw at the age of 12 years old. And she'd started 3 years before when she was molested. And the trauma of that meant alcohol was her only comfort. So that was a pretty sad sort of situation. And some people are more disturbed in that area than other people are. There can be events. It can be a crisis, or it can be just a drifting in. People who go to parties on a Saturday night, and you know, it's not unusual for people to drink pretty heavily and to pass around other sort of drugs and that sort of stuff. So peer pressure can be another thing. The person's own disposition. I mean, I'm built in such a way that after one or two glasses of wine, I don't want any more. I just don't feel like having any more. But there are others who, after one or two glasses of wine, they just want to keep going and they can't stop. And one's too many and a thousand's not enough. The stories are varied. There are some people who get involved in the illicit drug trade, and then to keep the illicit drug trade going, $200, $300 a day, that's pretty hard unless you go into stealing, dealing or prostitution as possible ways of doing things. Sometimes they're in dysfunctional relationships where the only one who loves me is the one who beats me up. How do I know he loves me? Because he beats me up. Well, that's a pretty unhealthy sort of a relationship with that sort of thing. But so there are many and varied. But it does seem that some people have a disposition, genetic or personality-wise, so that if they... once they start taking an addictive agent, they get hooked on it and then they continue on with it.
Here's a question for you, Alan. Are addicts bad people? Because I feel like that, you know, there's this temptation for us to be like addicts, that it's a character problem, right? It's, you know, they need more self-control, they just need to not have that drink or not, you know, not pick up that substance. Is it just a character problem, or they just, you know, there's an internal heart issue they just need to fix, or what's going on there?
Look, this is a very ideological sort of a situation. There are those of us in the medical profession who say, look, it's an illness, it's not a moral issue. But I think we've explored the moral issue in terms of choices and consequences, so that we do recognise there's a moral dimension to it as well. If you say it's an illness, then you've got to wait for the doctor to fix you, and I think that that's not terribly helpful. A lady sent me a note recently saying, what is the detailed plan to fix my husband? I wrote back saying, dear madam, your husband's not a car and I'm not a mechanic. I am prepared to go on a journey with him as he goes on a journey of his own discovery as to how he's going to find what his improvement is. Now, I don't know whether that makes it... That's not quite the medical model, if you like. It's much more of a behavioural model. So it becomes a bit complicated. Some people, you tell them, look, you're drinking too much, you've got to stop, then that's sufficient. So the education model can be helpful there. We've also implied that there are social dimensions to it as well. So you've got that, whoever your peers are, that can be an important shaper of things. So, I mean, I think it's not possible to put it into any one particular category. And I certainly think that we should rescue it out of the hands of Christians who might want to put it into their moral and moralism sort of category. It's much broader than that. But then Christian ethics is much broader than morality, isn't it, really? Because what in the end is Christian ethics? Christian ethics is, I'm not good enough, but with the Spirit of God I can change. Change to do what? To become like him, that is, to become like Jesus. Now, what sort of a Jesus do I want to become like? Because sometimes you think that the word Jesus is a bit of a Rorschach blot. I will work out what, you know, but it's not quite like that, because the Gospels do give us some indication of the sort of quality of personality that Christ is, and in Christ we see who the Father is. And of course, I think very deeply we find that boils down to one single four-letter word, and that's the word love. And that, I think, is the important thing. I think if the limbic system of the brain, as we've talked about before, is about relationality, and relationships is about love, then I think addiction and the Christian gospel have a lot in going for it, in the sense of sharing the love of God. Now, as we said before, robust love is about setting good boundaries, and it's not about just letting you do whatever you want. God's love is not like that. God's love is a stern love of discipline and those sort of things as well. So just because you've sort of used a loving term, that doesn't mean that that's all there is to it.
So you've talked there about a few different models that people might use to think about addiction. So we talked about, there was the medical, educational, social. Was there another one as well?
Moral.
Spiritual, moral, yeah.
Spiritual.
And then you kind of ended talking about love and saying, yep, how there needs to be a response of love. What does that look like in practice? What can we actually do? You know, if we have a friend who's experiencing addiction, what do we do about that?
Look, I think this is... One of the greatest gifts that God gives us is the gift of freedom. I mean, what sort of God is it that he allows humans to discover opium and allows us to discover cannabis and allows us to grow cannabis and alcohol and all of those sort of things? Why does he allow us to have these good gifts which we can then use or abuse? What's going on here? They're big questions. What was your question again?
It was about what can we do?
What can we do?
Yeah.
Well, what is true love? One of the major problems I find is the anxious parent who brings their child in. And one of the problems, of course, is that if you're afraid, you then start to control. And the more you try to control, the more they rebel. Because change has got to come from within. Change cannot be imposed from without. So what can we do? Well, what's the loving thing to do, as I said before, about setting boundaries and not enabling, and yet at the same time listening and affirming, as indeed Stuart's story showed us that that's what happened to him. There was somebody there who, in a non-judgmental way, did that. But, I mean, I'm talking about non-judgmental. I do think that one of the things that I do in my counselling is to talk about choices and consequences. So, you know, you need to be aware of the consequences of what you're doing. Can I tell a story? It was a lady, I was taking a spiritual history, which is part of what I do for some of my patients, and she said to me, I said to her, do you have a faith commitment? How I put it. Oh, she said, no. I've read the Bible through twice and I disagree with it. I said to myself, lady, you'll keep. But outwardly, I didn't say anything. I just accepted that. And then she went through our program and she learned to enjoy herself and she learned to self-esteem and that sort of stuff. And the last day, I wrote on a piece of paper, there is no fear in love, for perfect love casts out fear. She looked at it, and she looked at me, and she said, wow, where did that come from? To which I said, that's for you to find out. 15 minutes later, there was a little note slipped under the nurse's station, and it said 1 John 4, verse 18. Thanks with a triple exclamation mark. If I had gone into an argument with her when she said, you've read the Bible through twice, and she disagrees with it, and talked about the Bible being a library of books formed over 1,500 years, and that in fact it isn't one book, it's 66 books, and there are a lot of good things in the Bible and all that sort of stuff, she wouldn't have taken any of that in. But just by infiltrating that little quote in there, it's one of my favourite quotes. People have put it up on the walls of their bedrooms and on the fridge magnet. There is no fear in love, for perfect love casts out fear. That's gospel, and that's enormously telling. And then, of course, the rest of our lives we spend trying to work out what that love might be in the practical relationships of living with flawed human beings, where we need to learn how to give and to take and to love and to care for. And, of course, love is something that occurs in a community, not just between couples, and a community like this one. And, of course, St. Alf's is known for the love that it has towards one another, I hope. I hope.
So you're saying that in some ways our response, or sort of the fix, or the thing we can do about addiction, is just to love people and be in community?
Well, I think there's a bit more to it than that, because I think that sometimes people do need to go through a detox program, and sometimes medications can be helpful. Certainly some of the withdrawal syndromes shouldn't be handled by amateurs, although there are a number of organisations, and the government's currently talking about these amateur detox places that there are around the place, who charge a heck of a lot of money and who have a very truncated view of what recovery is all about. Sometimes expert input is required. Support without enabling, firm boundary settings, I think, are probably sort of the features that I would sort of talk about most, I think, in that sort of area.
Cool. Yeah, I found that quote that you had quite helpful about just thinking about perfect love casting out fear, because I think people that I've known who've struggled with addiction or substance abuse, there's often a lot of fear. Hey, there's fear of discovery, fear of what people think of you, maybe fear of punishment or of legal consequences. There's a lot of fear. And so I find that quite a challenging sort of thought, is how can we love in a perfect way that actually removes people's fear?
Look, I think that's right, but I think by the same token, there are people who will be facing legal consequences about what they've done, and they need to recognise that true love says, let's face up to those consequences and let's deal with those.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Yeah.
And so, I have people who knock on the door saying, I need a detox. Why do you need a detox? Well, I'm going to go to jail if I don't. And when's the court case? Oh, next week. And when was the offence? Oh, 18 months ago. Oh, right. Well, why don't you go to the magistrate, get this court case sorted out, and then we'll do a detox after that. That's a sort out the bogus from the genuine. And I think that doesn't sound very loving, does it? But you know what I mean?
Depends on your definition of love.
You can always play around, can't you? Yeah. You theologians, all the hair splitting that goes on. Yeah, right. Let's play around with definitions. Yeah.
You caught me out.
All right. So, it becomes a line ball. And yet, on the other hand, when a person says, look, I've done these things, I really am sorry, I did them last week, my court case won't be for months, what can I do in the meantime? Come on, let's do what we can to get you in a different headspace, a different frame of mind, and then let's see what we can present to the courts.